Two, three, four. There we go. Thank you. Well, maybe I'll just share with you how we got invited in the first place. And the Great Firewall of China does not block out our reasons.org website. I was amazed at how much stuff does get blocked out. But our site goes through without any edits whatsoever. And therefore, people in China know about us through the web. And when I got there, I discovered that young earth creationists kind of own the Christian community, both in Hong Kong and throughout China. They've invested very heavily there. And it was an international school in Hong Kong was my first stop. And international school is a school for expatriates. So all the teaching is in English. And in Hong Kong, as well as in Qingdao, where I went later, there are quite a number of expatriates. And they have the right to have their children taught in Western-style schools with English instruction, and there's no restriction on what they can be taught. And so almost all of the international schools are run by Christians. And so the one that I was at in Hong Kong, as well as the one in Qingdao, the staff are all Christians. And not all the students are Christians. Typically, about half the students will be Christians and half are not. But for several years now, they've been having a week where a young earth creationist leader will come in and provide the science education part on creation. Yes?
When you say expatriates, are you talking about Chinese people who have gone elsewhere and agreed to come back under allowance?
An expatriate is someone who has a foreign passport. And some of them are native Chinese, but they've been to the States, they've got an American citizenship, and they've come back. But, for example, international churches throughout China, and you have to show your passport at the door to get in. But the international churches, again, are not supervised by the government, so they can do whatever they want. It's complete freedom. A lot of Chinese try to get in, and sometimes they don't watch the passports that carefully, so sometimes they do get in, and they get to hear a message that has no censorship at all. So, but that's usually the way it goes. You have to show your passport. And these schools are for children whose parents have passports or they have passports. Sometimes they're native Chinese, but the kids have passports. So that's how you can enroll. This is one of the largest international schools throughout China. It has over 1,000 students attending. So, and they actually have three principals and a guy in charge. So, and Hong Kong is quite different from the rest of China. You actually need to go through immigration and customs to go from Hong Kong into China. And so the border between Hong Kong and China, even though it's a part of China, is very tightly controlled. And in Hong Kong itself, there is a considerable religious freedom. It's also a place where they allow political protests. It's the only place in China where they have political protests. So actually in Hong Kong, they have this big square, and this is where Chinese will come in from all over China on trains and buses, and they'll do their protests. And then they get to go back. They're not allowed to do it in China, but they can do it in Hong Kong. So, and they have a free press. I mean, it's basically treated like a separate country. So, but Hong Kong, as you're probably well aware, is a very crowded city. It's not uncommon for them to have 100,000 people in a square kilometer. I mean, the typical situation in Hong Kong is they'll have a four-story mall that covers a couple of square blocks, and on top of that four-story mall are 30-story apartment complexes. And it's not uncommon in one apartment building for 5,000 people to live. And so if you got, say, 12 of those in a complex, well, that's 60,000 people living within a few square blocks. So, and then there's a subway station underneath. And, if you kind of work things out, you never have to go outside. So, you just go down the building and get your groceries right up below there. It's movie theater or whatever. And then you take the train to go to work and, so that's kind of what Hong Kong is like. A bit unnerving because I try to walk around there and lots of places there are no sidewalks and the traffic is pretty horrendous. So, on my way I went from L.A. to Tokyo to Hong Kong because the flights that go to Hong Kong get you there early in the morning. And that's a real killer for the jet lag, is to be there early in the morning. So I wound up to find an evening flight. But on the way up to Tokyo, I had a Japanese artist sitting beside me, 25 years of age. My son, my older son, is also an artist, same age. And he didn't speak good English, but he had one of these translator devices with him. And so we communicated through this electronic Japanese-English translator. It actually worked pretty well. I was amazed at how well it did work. But he's not a Christian. He's been through a divorce already. But he was very eager to hear about our organization. Wanted me to show him some of the messages I was going to be giving in China. So I took him through some of my keynotes. And at the end of it, he says, "I've got to get on your mailing list." Says, "I really, you wanted to enroll in everything." So wanted to get the Today's New Reason to Believe, get the magazine. Says, "Anything free, I want that." So so he got all signed up. And then the flight to Hong Kong, a similar situation happened. It was a young woman, probably about 30 years of age. And I was working on my keynotes because, you know, the thing about China is they change things at the last minute. So as I got on the plane, I got an email to the effect that they wanted some changes in my talk. So I was working on my messages, and then she got very curious. But I could see she was reading what I was putting down there, and she kept ordering more and more drinks because the drinks were free. So is that conviction or what? So I heard he didn't get to talk to her, but she was reading, and every time she read a slide or two, she'd order another drink. So.
Can you show us some slides?
Yeah, maybe I could. So, but I arrived there Thursday and had to speak all day Friday. And then there was a meeting Thursday night where we went over last-minute changes to the talks, and there were even more changes to the talks. So I had to stay up a little bit after the dinner meeting and try to get everything ready for the next day. What I had prepared, we were supposed to each get 25 minutes, and each, I should tell you, is that I wasn't really there unopposed. As I said, they've had this week session in the past exclusively young earth creationists. And several of the science teachers at this school said, you know, we got to have an alternative to this. They're pretty upset about this constant stream of young earth creationism. As I later found out, it wasn't even the best young earth creationism. and so they set up this thing where the students and the faculty would be exposed to three different positions: young earth creationism, theistic evolution, and the position we represent at Reasons to Believe. And they invited Daryl Falk to represent the theistic evolution, or what he prefers, the evolutionary creationist position. Although, to be frank, I've yet to see the difference between the two positions. He's the president of BioLogos, probably the leading theistic evolutionary or evolutionary creationist organization in the world now. And then a fellow by the name of Jerry Layton, who represented the Young Earth position. He had been on that campus several times. In fact, he travels throughout Asia giving seminars on Young Earth creationism. And I tried for some time to figure out what his doctorate was in, because it was Dr. Jerry Layton, and at the last minute discovered that it's an honorary doctorate, and he has a bachelor's degree, and that's it. So, and that, you know, really came out as we began to develop the thing. But it all started off where we had an assembly with all the students and teachers from 8th to 12th grade, about 500 total. And Daryl Falk spoke first, then Jerry Layton, and I had the last slot. And we were supposed to each have 25 minutes to present our position. They chopped it down to 7. So I had to find a way to condense my message down to just 7 minutes. That's because they wanted Q&A from the students. So we had 25 minutes of Q&A, and they had changed the class discussion. So the whole schedule that day had been changed. So each of us had 7 minutes, and Daryl started off, and he basically gave us testimony of how he was raised in a Christian home. Incidentally, he was raised about 8 miles from where I was raised, in Burnaby, British Columbia. I was raised in Vancouver, and we're about the same age. So it's really interesting how our backgrounds were so different. He had been saturated in the Christian community. I didn't even get to know Christians, and yet we were being raised at the same time, just 8 miles apart. But he talked about how, you know, as he got into biology, it caused him to walk away from his faith because he saw biology contradicting everything he'd been taught. He'd been exposed to the young earth position. And then he described how he eventually recovered from that loss. Several years he did not go to church and really didn't practice his faith at all, but eventually came back. And he said it was this evolutionary creationist position that brought him back, where he realized, I can believe what all my biology professors are telling me and still be a Christian. Although he takes a very different interpretation on Adam and Eve and human origins than we do at Reasons to Believe. And then Dr. Layton got up and basically gave another testimony where he talked about how he was raised as an evolutionist, taught high school biology, and a student gave him a book from Dwayne Gish, The Fossils Say No, and how that converted into a young earth position and led him into a ministry where he speaks all over Asia. He literally speaks to millions of people. And but from what I can tell, unlike Daryl and myself, he doesn't really do any research or reading. And it was clear that his data was quite a bit behind the times. He spends all of his time speaking. So, and then we had 25 minutes of Q&A with prepared questions from the audience. Yes. Well,
simply because China can trace its roots back to what? About 9,000, 11,000 BC? I mean, they have historical records, so, I mean, this presents a major problem.
Well, and that is interesting because Daryl Falk would, you know, he's 4,004 BC, or probably not Daryl Falk, Jerry Layton. And yeah, you're right, the Chinese have historical records that predate 4,004 BC. So. But you're right in the sense that if you were to go back, say, 3 decades, the Chinese church was old earth. But what I discovered is particularly Answers in Genesis has invested heavily in Asia. Their textbooks are everywhere in the Christian schools. And then they sponsor speakers. So basically because of their money, they've been able to take over much of the Christian community throughout Asia, not just China, but the Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, particularly Korea, has been taken over. So anyway, we had that 7 minutes each. We had a Q&A. The questions were prepared and written ahead of time, so it wasn't all that helpful. And it would have been good if we actually had some exchange with one another, but we didn't have that opportunity. And then I was whisked off to address the 12th grade religions class. And the topic was, what's unique about Christianity? That's kind of the course they were taking. So I gave a talk on the Bible's unique predictive power, how until the 20th century, the Bible stood alone in predicting Big Bang cosmology, and likewise what it said about the Genesis 1 creation account, not finding that in any other account of creation in any other religion. And then went through the prophecies of Daniel as something that uniquely is predictive, because everybody recognizes that if Daniel was written in the 6th century BC, then there's no doubt that the book of Daniel is predicting future historical events, and how the skeptics will claim that Daniel was written centuries later than the 6th century BC, but I just gave them all the textual evidence that that can't possibly be correct. You see a lot of terminology in Daniel that is unique to the 6th century BC and does not show up in future documents, and how future documents trying to write about the events really couldn't understand the language because things have been lost in the centuries following. So just trying to show them that the book of Daniel really does stand as proof that the Bible not only predicts future scientific discoveries, but actually predicts future historical events in considerable detail. Daniel, for example, predicted that the Babylonian Empire would be taken over by the Medes and the Persians, and the Medes and the Persians, in turn, would be taken over by the Greeks, and how the Greek king would suffer an early death and his kingdom be split into four pieces, and finally the Romans would come and take over what the Greeks had established. And all that took place, also predicted the timing of the coming of the Messiah, what would happen to the Messiah, how he would be killed in his city, and then much later would come. So then they brought me in to talk to the fourth and the fifth graders. So I had to have a talk for that level. And I gave my Beyond the Cosmos talk, where instead of talking about all the scientific ways we've proven that the universe is 10 space-time dimensions and getting into the space-time theorems, I dropped all that and went straight to my Mr. and Mrs. Flat demonstration and trying to give people an idea of how it is that God can listen to all of our prayers, how it's impossible for us to see or touch him, but you know, he's closer physically to us than we are to one another, explained the Trinity to them, and the atonement, I think, was particularly helpful, how with three dimensions of time, we can easily explain how Jesus could atone for the sins of all humanity in just 9 hours on the cross. That's one way he could do it. It led to a lot of great questions from the fourth and fifth graders. And the teachers were surprised. We had no idea our kids were this bright. But I said, well, all you need to do is give them the right subject material, and they'll go off with it. In fact, I made the comment that the younger the human being, the easier it is for them to assimilate this transdimensional theology, because children, when they're very young, transition from two-dimensional thinking to three-dimensional thinking. The difficulty is trying to communicate this to teachers who are 40 and 50 years of age. The kids got it just like that. So another good demonstration of how that works. Yes.
I would think that China and Asia probably would be a kind of fertile ground for this kind of spiritual thing, because they believe in evil spirits. I mean, big time. You know, they can put a, they say evil spirits cannot go in a straight line, so they put blocking things inside their houses and temples and all that. So I would think that
Well, Al, you're on to something, because that happened to me when I was in Soviet Russia, is that they believed in the supernatural because they saw so many evidences of the activity of demons. And in parts of China, that's also true. Hong Kong, not so much, but in Qingdao, everybody believes in demons because of the fact that there's so much occult activity there. They actually see some physical demonstrations of demonic activity, just like what I saw in Russia, mainly because you had all these universities that sponsored departments of occult physics. So they were actually doing research in the occult. And not surprising, they were attracting the activity of demons. So sixth and seventh graders was next. And I gave a similar talk on God's transdimensionality, but kind of also added the evidence that we have scientifically that God must be at least that powerful. But they also wanted me to respond to the challenges of evolutionism. And they had heard from Jerry Layton in years before how to respond to evolutionism, and basically showed them a different way to respond, one that had more credibility. And what was interesting is this school actually has a special class for autistic kids. And they didn't know that I was also autistic, so when they found out that I was autistic, they said, well, you've got to address this class. So I got the top of the class and the teacher, and I really tried to encourage the teachers, you know, you need to mainstream these kids as quickly as you can, keeping them in a special class, especially those that have particular talents. You need to get them in there, into a place where they can be much more productive. And so they asked me a lot of questions about how I handled my autism when I was a child. And I said, well, you know, once you get some kind of pass from the teachers on the handwriting, that makes a big difference. You know, when you're, people are autistic when they're really young, they just are very clumsy physically. They bump into people. They have a hard time controlling their body. And they can't print or write. And fortunately, the school I went to, they basically gave me a pass on my legibility. And I said, you know, that's kind of what you need to do with these students, is, you know, as long as they know the math and as long as they know the spelling, and they probably do very well at both, you know, you just kind of let the verbal stuff slide and let the printing and writing slide, and get them mainstreamed that way. But it was fun to talk to them about, you know, just their struggles. So, and then we had a panel discussion in front of the biology class. That was probably the most interesting event of the day, because all three of us were at a table talking to all of these high school biology students. And we just let them ask questions. And what basically it wound up into was a debate between Jerry Layton and myself on the validity of young Earth creationism, and in particularly the whole idea that if you take a young Earth perspective, you're forced into a hyper-evolutionary paradigm, which is something that Jerry Layton really didn't appreciate. I shouldn't use the word appreciate. He didn't understand. So it was a revelation to him that from a young Earth perspective, you really do have to endorse hyper-evolution. And you know, I kind of walked him through and said, yeah, yeah, you're right. I never really saw that before. But likewise, the students in the class hadn't seen that before. If you're not familiar with it, in the young Earth paradigm, they believe that there was no carnivorous activity until Adam sinned. And so after the sin of Adam, you got all these herbivorous animals rapidly evolving into carnivores, you know, developing long teeth, and their whole internal digestive system changes. And I mean, it really is a hyper-evolution. And they run into it a second time because they believe that the flood of Noah wiped out all land life on Earth, and therefore all the land species we see in the planet today, about 10 million plus species, they would claim rapidly evolved from a few thousand or less on board the Ark. And once again, they're appealing to, you know, hyper-evolution. I also noticed that Daryl Falk hadn't heard this before either. So, and he just says, you know, Hugh, I'm not going to get into this. You just keep talking. So, so I'm learning stuff here. So, and Jerry, to his credit, also was gracious. Said, you know, I'm learning things I never knew before about this whole idea of evolutionism. So there's a question here. Yes.
Yes, I was curious on these three views. Which one appeals to the atheistic person or worldly person more? You know, which I think the young Earth people would appeal to a person who's already a Christian, whereas your approach and the you know, theistic evolution would appeal to the atheist more, the person who's just a seeker and just ignorant of Christianity. I don't see where a young Earth creationism would appeal to a person who's just not a Christian or not anything.
Well, as I tried to explain to the students, the universe shouts age. I mean, there's no way you can actually look at the universe and see it as anything other than something that's billions of years old. The Earth to a lesser degree, but the universe just screams age everywhere you look. And so, and then said, well, you know, tell us something. So I just kind of gave them some idea how big the universe is. And I found out they had really gotten very little education on astronomy. I mean, what's interesting about this school is they have 100% graduation rate from university. Not just 100% entry into university, 100% of their students get at least a bachelor's degree from a well, you know, a big name school. So these are typically kids that are quite bright and well educated, but when it came to astronomy, they had not been exposed to much. So. And, you know, that's typical of a young Earth curriculum. It tends to be really weak on astronomy. You know, typically they talk about the solar system, and that's about where it ends. And, you know, once you get past the solar system, you run into the light travel time problem. That's a challenge for the young Earth paradigm. So they really don't learn much about galaxies and stars. But it was fun to talk to the students. And what was interesting is how excited they got. They're all very eager to get our resources. So that panel discussion went on for an hour, and it was the one time where we did have some good interaction. And then they had me address a combined 11th and 12th grade class, and there I talked about the origin of physical life and the origin of human beings, kind of what the talk I'm planning to give over several weeks here in this class. I got that jammed into 1 hour and 5 minutes. And, it'll be weeks. And then just to wrap up what happened on Friday, last of all, they had me address the 12th grade world religions class. And again, it was part two. What's unique about the Bible compared to other religions? And this is where I talked about the Bible having a unique transdimensional perspective, how every other religion kind of puts God in a four-dimensional box, but Christianity doesn't. And because they were 12th graders, I was able to give them the scientific evidence that indeed God transcends length, width, height, and time. And so that kind of wrapped up Friday. And we had a talk with the teachers and the principal over dinner later on that evening. And they let me know that they had, through our website, had actually been reading our books. A number of the teachers had read the books, and so that's why you got invited. We found your website, started reading the books, and saying, you know, we need to give our students another perspective. But they felt that the way to do it is to kind of give them the full range, or at least a good part of the range, of beliefs within evangelical Christianity. And this was all preparation for Saturday. Saturday was the big event where they invited the parents, they invited community people, anybody could come. But they were concerned about Saturday because up until Friday, they'd only had 100 people sign up. But the students got so excited about the events that come Saturday morning, there were over 250 people there. So 150 people plus signed up just within a few hours after the Friday event. So they were very excited about the teachers going home and telling their parents and friends, you got to check this out. But everybody got this. This is kind of the Saturday syllabus that they put out. And it's called Light Not Heat, Developing Awareness of Origins. And what they told me is that in the past they've had these Saturday seminars, and it's basically been the young earth position attacking all the other positions. And they said, no, what we're going to have this time is all the positions represented, and we're going to encourage all the speakers to present a positive case for their position and not go on the attack on other positions. So, yeah.
Why was not there any agnostics or atheists here?
Well, this was a Christian seminar, so... and we actually talked about that. We had agnostics, but we did have them in the audience. So like especially the seminar breakouts I had, I tended to get the unbelievers attending mine. I'll talk to you about a Buddhist. I got a dramatic story about a Buddhist coming up. So, but you know, what you have in Hong Kong, it sits there. The Christian faith is quite strong in Hong Kong. There's churches everywhere, and probably most people that identify themselves as Christian. Buddhism is not that strongly represented. There are Buddhists there, but it's not the dominant faith. Christianity clearly is the dominant faith by a wide margin. You do have a few Muslims, but again, they're in the minority. And you do have agnostics and atheists. But what's interesting, when you talk to the Chinese that have grown, been there for generations, they say, it's the expatriates that are the agnostics and the atheists. We're not agnostics and atheists. We never have been. So apparently that's not a popular position there. But I did have some expatriate atheists and agnostics come to my breakout sessions. So, and we did actually talk about in the future we might want to bring in. But they felt, you know, step one, all we've had is young earth till now. Step two, let's at least expose our Christian community to the different options on creation theology within the realm of Christianity, and then we can go from there and do a proper outreach. Because that's what I was saying. Hey, you know, this is great that you're spending all this money to make this happen. Well, let's really turn this into an outreach. And he said, well, that's for the future. We'll do that in the future. And I can see the value of this. We have to really get Christians prepared to deal with these issues. Yes. Oh, I forgot to say what I did. I told you what Falk did and Leighton did. No, not in 7 minutes. Yeah. Well, on Saturday, I got to do that because there I had a little more time. But, you know, as I listened to Falk and Leighton, they were basically giving testimonies. And I was told ahead of time, present a summary of your position. And so that's what I did, and I just took my 25-minute talk and kind of trimmed it down to 7 minutes. But what people told me afterwards, they appreciated that I gave content, not just a story. And so I didn't give any testimony at all, but talked about how it reasons to believe. We believe that God gave us two books, the book of nature, the book of scripture, and how they can be fully integrated and kind of labeled at a constructive integration model in creation theology. And then spent a couple of minutes doing a quick survey of the what I consider the best new scientific evidences for an inerrant Bible and the Christian faith. Got all that jammed into 7 minutes. Moved pretty fast. But the audience really liked the fact that I gave content. So that was my 7 minutes. Well, Saturday started off the same way. Only each of us had 25 minutes now to present our case, as opposed to just 7 minutes. And since I spoke last the night before, they had me speak first. I spoke first, Jerry Layton spoke second, and Daryl Falk spoke last. And so I took the 25-minute talk I prepared and gave the whole 25-minute talk, which means I could lay out in some detail the philosophical basis of our position of constructive integration. And then spent quite a bit, instead of reviewing the scientific evidences, I said, I'm going to do that in the afternoon. Because the way it was organized, each of us had 25 minutes to open up the morning, followed by a long breakout session where people could get to choose which one they wanted to go to. And then right after lunch, we got together again, where each of us had 25 minutes. And then after that, another breakout session. Then it was followed by a long Q&A. So I knew I was going to have another 25 minutes. And in that 25 minutes, my intent was to review the best new scientific evidences for the Christian faith. And I also realized they were going to be hearing from Layton and Falk that Genesis 1 cannot possibly be integrated with established science. So realizing that's what they were going to hear from the other two speakers, in my opening 25 minutes, I quickly took them through Genesis 1, showing how we can take this two-books model, how God gave us the book of nature and the book of scripture, and said, let me show you how this works on the first page. So, because I'd heard previously from Falk and Layton that they believed that was impossible to do. So I just kind of showed them how it could be done. And, you know, that's how I came to Christ, partly how I came to Christ, and kind of laid that out in a straightforward way. And then in my breakout session, I talked about why the universe is the way it is, because I felt, you know, that gives them a nice big picture of what creation's all about. And I have no idea what Daryl Falk and Layton spoke on, because we each were in different sessions. But I got some very interesting questions when I talked about why the universe is the way it is. Namely, they want to know why God would have 3.8 billion years of life on planet Earth, that his plan was really to bring about the end of all evil, which is kind of what I was talking about, where the universe has the physics that's optimally designed to bring about a rapid and efficient conquest and removal of evil. And I said, well, what's all this life for then? So just explaining why the Creator would have such an abundance and diversity of life for so long on planet Earth, because that's what's necessary, number one, to compensate for the changing physics of the solar system, but number two, to provide the resources that humanity needs to achieve the purpose that God has given us in such a brief period of time. I mean, we're only here for a few tens of thousands of years, and we got a lot to do in those few tens of thousands of years, and we need a lot of resources. So it's interesting that the questions that went in that direction. By the way, in the opening morning, both Layton and Falk basically gave a longer version of the testimony they gave the day before, which I was a little bit surprised, because they were specifically told, present content, present the philosophy of your case, and that didn't happen. They did in the afternoon, but in the morning, they just gave their testimony, and basically the same as what we'd heard the day before, although in the case of Jerry Layton, we also had a long advertising for his Asia-wide ministry. So he was talking about all the seminars he gives and how you can sign up for that and that kind of a thing. Okay, in the afternoon to me was the most interesting because hearing Dr. Layton, he talked about a science education conspiracy, this idea that you know, science educators, especially at the university level, are purposely deceiving their students about the truth about science. And he spent a long time trying to give biblical and scientific proof that the flood of Noah was global in extent. And that was a bit surprising because we had a Q&A in front of the students the day before where we did talk a little bit about the flood. And I talked about why I do believe the Bible teaches a worldwide flood but not a global flood, and talked about the difference between global and worldwide. He seemed to ignore all that. And when he had his 25 minutes, because he knew there was going to be no chance for a rebuttal, just spent his time going through the Bible, showing all the places where the Bible talks about the flood being worldwide, and therefore it must be global, and that explains all the geology on the surface of the earth, and you know how there was this continent that was all one split apart during the flood. So I could tell Daryl was just shaking his head, saying, "You know, this is just crazy." But I said, "Well, you know, it's not just the science stuff that's way off. The Bible stuff is way off as well." But that's how he spent his 25 minutes. And Daryl, I appreciate what he said, because for the first time, I've been trying, you know, I've had many meetings with Daryl, trying to figure out where he stood on different issues, and this is where he was the clearest in stating what his position was. Namely, that he believes that God works behind the scenes through gradual process, and everything in the record of nature is gradual. So he strongly promoted the principle of gradualism. And as proof for that, rather surprising, he talked about the Cambrian explosion being a gradual phenomenon, how it stretched over 100 million years. But I noticed all the references he was giving were 20th century references. None were 21st century references. And he claimed that there were jawless fish didn't show up until 50 million years after the Cambrian. And there was lots of Chinese in the audience who knew about the Yunnan fossil beds, which give a very different answer. So, but then he spent quite a bit of time, too, in DNA similarities, because, you know, Falk also takes the position that it's common descent, that all life on planet Earth comes about through common natural descent. So he believed, for example, that chimpanzees and humans can be traced back to a common ancestor through gradual process. And so he talked about the DNA similarities between humans and chimpanzees, and then brought up chromosome 2. And it's interesting how frequently evolutionary creationists or theistic evolutionists will look at chromosome 2 as proof for common descent. Excuse me, I picked up a Shanghai virus, so there's dust there. I mean, when I was in Shanghai, there was this all this dust in the atmosphere, and I say everybody who lands in Shanghai from the West gets this thing. So, kind of happened to me, went to South Africa as well. Anyway, they talk about the fused chromosome, and I might be able to actually pop that up for you here. I think I've discussed this in the class here before, but I was surprised that it came up again. Yeah, here we go. I mean, if you look at the chimpanzee, it has 48 chromosomes, and humans have 46 chromosomes. And what Daryl was claiming is that we're descended from a common ancestor, and somewhere in that line of common descent, two chimpanzee chromosomes fused together to become a human chromosome, and gives evidence of the fact that, you have kind of like aglets at the end of a chromosome. So we call them telomeres, and these are kind of like the endpoints of a chromosome. And if you look at chromosome 2, you see what looks like to be two telomeres in the middle of the chromosome, and these are what are called centrosomes, and they appear to be here too. But if you actually look at the scientific literature on this, these are true telomeres right here. What we see here, what they call vestigial telomeres or centromeres. In other words, they kind of look like it, but they're not exactly like it. Not even very close, as a matter of fact. And, the problem with that line of reasoning is, we do see events where chromosomes will fuse or split in all kinds of life. But whenever that happens, it's catastrophic. And what we have here, this is really a fused event. It must have been God that did the fusion. because under a gradual natural process, you do not get a desirable outcome. It's always a catastrophic outcome. And moreover, I'm not really convinced that we're seeing here are true centromeres or telomeres. But it is true that we have 23 chromosome pairs, and the apes have 23. And if you actually look at the rest of the chromosome or the genome for the apes, you see significant differences that would challenge the common descent paradigm, particularly the DNA that governs brain energy pathways, very different in humans than it is in apes. And yet there are other animals that are very similar to humans as opposed to apes, particularly mice and rats, which would mean that we must have a common ancestor with mice and rats in that case, but nobody would ever claim that. So, but, you know, back to the what happened on Saturday, I need to move this along because I want to tell you a little bit about Qingdao. My breakout session after that was about the three origins of life, the lessons spiritually we get from soulish animals, and one of the questions we got from the audience, because I'd just given a presentation on the best scientific evidence for the God of the Bible, we had a long discussion, how come Christians never use this evidence? And it's because they were hearing it for the first time. And so with evidence this potent and not that difficult to understand, how come Christians aren't using this evidence? And that I didn't really have to answer for them. They figured out on their own that it's offensive to the evolutionary creationist position. It's also offensive to the younger creationist position. And since they're the predominant players in the Christian community, the evidence never gets presented. But they said this is exactly what we need to reach China for Christ. I mean, that kind of comment came up again and again. It says if the Chinese were just to hear this stuff, it would have a big impact. And basically, I encourage them, well, you need to present it. Get the material out there. We can't do it by ourselves. And then after that, we had a Q&A from the floor. But they were so worried that there would be heat, not light, that they did not have an open Q&A. That's kind of what I wanted. I always prefer to have, you know, questions from the floor. But finally, they did concede after a couple of written questions. They said, could we alternate? I said, well, they weren't seeing a lot of heat from the audience. So I said, yeah, let's try that. So we finished off a Q&A session where we would take a question from the floor and then one from the written pile that had been screened to make sure it wasn't too offensive. And, you know, I said, look, there are non-Christians in the audience. If all you do is take the screen questions, you lose credibility. And they said, well, yeah, given the fact that that's the case, let's go ahead and take some from the floor. And that was really good. Questions we got were predominantly people who were challenging Daryl Falk and Jerry Layton. A lot of people wanted to put him on the spot. So I kind of got a free ride in that case. Although people did ask me about the faint sun paradox, why I felt that we need a different life at different times, and why God would intervene and remove life from the planet and replace it. Talked about Psalm 104, and it really made the point about the importance of integration. A lot of people said we've never heard this integration technique used before, and why that's so important in trying to reach non-Christians throughout China. What was fun for me, as I've been to Hong Kong before, I was there 15 years ago, just before the British gave up sovereignty to the Chinese. And my translator was at the Saturday seminar from 15 years ago. I immediately recognized him. And the four physicists who had set up events at the four different universities, major universities in Hong Kong, were there as well. And so we talked about what we need to do to set up a Reasons to Believe chapter there in Hong Kong. So that was fun. And then we had a dinner meeting afterwards to talk about future plans. This school wants to do a major Hong Kong event. And so we talked about, you know, what we can do in the future to reach out to the non-Christian community there. So there will probably be plans in the future to make something happen. And then Sunday morning, I got to speak in a church. There are a few international churches there. Spoke in downtown Hong Kong. There's an island which is nothing but skyscrapers. Kind of looks like Manhattan, only the buildings are squished much tightly, more tightly together. And spoke there on the sixth floor of this building. They wanted me to critique Stephen Hawking. interesting sermon title for a church, but I said, okay, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do. I found out it was a very educated congregation. And what was fun is they gave me 40 minutes to critique Stephen Hawking's new book, The Grand Design. And really, I didn't critique it that much. I kind of, what I want to do is contrast his model with our model, and it gives some focus on our model. But we had an hour of Q&A afterwards. So, you know, it's an hour and a half service, but it took a 10-minute break, and then we had another hour of a Q&A. And during the Q&A, I fielded a lot of questions on the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, and Genesis flood. And what I found out from the people there is that younger creationists have saturated Hong Kong with their flood geology. And they wanted me to, you know, kind of give a response for that. And said, does the Bible really teach a global flood? And it says, no. In fact, it's emphatically not teaching a global flood. And says, the problem is the younger community thinks that all the flood content in the Bible is Genesis 6, 7, and 8, and 2 Peter 3. But I said, let me take you through the Bible and show you all the places where it talks about the flood besides those two passages. And that was good because I was able to emphasize the integration approach. You know, kind of what I was doing throughout my time in Hong Kong. When you come to the Bible, you have to look at all 66 books. Don't assume all the creation content is just in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. You've got to go past Genesis. And so, in fact, one guy stood up in the audience and said, you mean to say not all the answers are in Genesis? But again, just kind of emphasizing our model of constructive integration. You've got to look at, you know, everything the Bible says about the flood, and particularly Psalm 104 that we've studied in Job 38 are quite emphatic in ruling out the possibility of a global flood. And therefore, the flood is not responsible for all the geology. I also heard that they had, well, of course, with the grand design by Stephen Hawking, I had questions on the multiverse and dealt with that. I'll take a question, then I want to move on and talk to you about Qingdao, because that was a very different situation. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's about the flood. We all believe it's a local flood, not a global one. But I had a kind of interesting, when we were talking about Peru, this is a scientific thing. I looked it up in Wikipedia.
Oh, great source, Wikipedia, yeah. That's funny, because Metaxas was asked a question here at church about where he got all of his research in Bonhoeffer, and he says, well, have you ever heard of Wikipedia?
Yeah, so the thing is that me and Ted and Chuck there were down there, and we never, being halfway scientific guys, we never did the experiment of, does the water drain counterclockwise or clockwise in that hemisphere? And so I was thinking, how about the flood? Did anybody notice what was it raining clockwise or counterclockwise? Is it in Genesis? Why is it?
Well,
can you explain the paradox? Because it says a lot of people, sailors, and people that go all over the world have tried it, and I didn't get any specific, you know.
Well, the idea is that the Coriolis force of the rotating Earth.
And it's an effect.
Yeah, it's an effect. Will cause water to go down the drain one way in the northern hemisphere, one way in the southern hemisphere. The effect is quite weak, and so it's easy to get it to go the other way in either hemisphere. So you can do experiments and find out for yourself.
Well, see,
the soap that was probably draining off your face would have been a stronger effect on the Coriolis effect. So it doesn't take much to disturb, get something better.
Coriolis force, when I was a weatherman, and we had to learn physics about weather. But, you know, we have anti-cyclones and cyclones.
Mm-hmm. Well, the effect will have a greater effect on the atmosphere than it will on water. So, yeah, as you found out, there's many ways to overcome the Coriolis effect. Well, I went through Shanghai, and I don't think I've ever seen such a polluted city as Shanghai. And You know, I looked at my schedule and says, I got a 5-hour layover in Shanghai. Why so long? I mean, Shanghai is a major hub. Well, I found out why so long, because they have an airport for all the Hong Kong and Taiwan flights and an airport for all the other flights. So, of course, I arrived in the Hong Kong airport, and then I found out I had to transfer to a different airport. Well, I said, you know, just show me where the sign is, because I was looking around there. And by the way, nobody spoke English. There were no signs telling you there was another airport. I thought, you know, there's got to be somewhere around here. I was walking around, and so I was showing people my my ticket, and they said, no, they're just shaking their head. And they kept pointing up this thing, you know, like they kept pointing up two fingers. And I said, what's that all about? Well, I figured out there was Airport 2 and Airport 1. Kind of worked that out through sign language. And then I said, you know, I put up my two and said, you know, where? And they pointed outside. I said, okay, there's got to be some kind of a bus or a train out there. And I went out there, and finally I found this thing that had the letter 2 on it. And so there was a guy on there who spoke English and said, is there another terminal, Terminal 2? And this is where you, he says, yep, just get on this thing. You need to, he says, you're going to Qingdao. You need to get on this bus. So only runs every half hour. And when the bus is full, you wait for the next one. So that's why they said 5 hours. And I discovered that Airport 2 is 8 miles away. And so, and then we went through this military zone, just barbed wire everywhere. But I couldn't believe the trash and the pollution. I mean, it's just, it looks like a third world suburb. I mean, I've seen, you know, more cleanliness in the slums of Nairobi than I saw there in Shanghai. So, and then the air is just really, really bad. And everybody's coughing. So no wonder I wound up coughing too. And then I got into Airport 2 and said, well, you know, I got a couple of hours to kill here. So I decided to test the Great Firewall of China. And I was amazed at how many sites you can't get into. Well, first of all, just trying to get on the web in China is a chore. It just takes, you know, like 5 minutes minimum just to get on the web. And it's because the firewall is trying to make sure that you're doing everything in a way that's amenable to the leaders there in China. But I tried to get on the website for Exoplanet Encyclopedia, blocked. And, you know, all kinds of academic sites I tried to get on, blocked, couldn't get in there. Reasons to Believe, wide open. So I said, you know, this French site I was trying to get on is totally academic. It was blocked. So afterwards, when I got to Qingdao, I says, can you explain this firewall to me? It doesn't make any sense. And he says, well, you got to realize there's a bunch of bureaucrats in Beijing, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're just blocking whatever they think they need to block to keep everybody from finding out about Tibet and Taiwan and Tiananmen Square and other things. And I said, you know, all you got to do is type Tibet into your computer and you'll be shut down from the internet for, you know, many days. You won't get on at all. Likewise, Taiwan's a bad word to throw in there. And Tiananmen Square, of course, and there were several other things you couldn't do. Oh, yeah, Gelanfeng, your Falun Gong, that'll immediately get you shut down. So, but I said, you know, I can't explain all these academic sites. You guys don't like the French or something? So they said, no, it's just a bureaucrat doing random things. So then I got to Qingdao, and I couldn't meet. I was supposed to be met at the airport. Nobody there. And and it was freezing cold. I mean, it was 20 degrees and a 20-mile-an-hour wind. So nobody was in the airport. So I decided to go outside and wait for somebody to pick me up. Nobody was picking me up. Half hour went by, so I decided to call the phone number they gave me, and it was the phone number of the school. I got the switchboard saying, we'll be open at 8 o'clock in the morning. This is great. Do I have to spend all night out here? And the guy said, we're going to be closing the airport soon. So I said, I don't want to spend all night outside, so figuring out where I could get a hotel or whatever. But finally, my host found me. And he was waiting for me in a completely different section of the airport. So that all worked out. But you never know on these trips. Anyway, spent 2 days at another international school. And then they set up an event for me impromptu. By the way, when I got to the school, I was supposed to speak 4 times each day. I wound up speaking 6 times each day. And on Wednesday, they wanted me to speak 8 times. And then they had an evening event at Qingdao University that they'd set up on the spot. And I said, well, look, you know, I haven't prepared anything in Mandarin. And, you know, if I'd known you wanted me to do this, I could have brought some Mandarin stuff with me because I did that before and I was in Hong Kong. And they said, well, we'll just get a translator. You know, we won't worry about the keynote. So they didn't get to see anything. And, I did show them the English version, and then we translated it. I'll tell you a quick story because I'm running out of time here. The event at the Qingdao University, literally organized Wednesday, while I was speaking at the high school and the junior high and middle school, they began organizing the event at Qingdao University. So people only had a few hours notice that the event was going to happen. But the room was packed to the gills. In fact, what they did is they took the chairs out, except for a few chairs for older people. They left those in so they could squeeze all the people in standing. And they had 2 doors into the room, and the hallway was packed with people. We got people from the house churches. So it was house church leaders. We had leaders from the Three Self Movement, which is the official government-sanctioned church. They were there. We had professors from the university and students from the university. And then we had a number of non-Christians who heard about the event and decided to come. So, and most of the students and professors weren't believers, so we had a really good discussion. But the Q&A time, which went on for a couple of hours, was dominated by a Buddhist skeptic. And he got up, and you know, it's difficult when they're speaking Mandarin. I didn't know what he was saying, but I could tell he was very hostile. And he went on and on and on and on. And here's my translator listening and nodding his head and then giving me a quick summary of what he had said. And his comment was, well, you know, a lot of what you said tonight, and by the way, I just spoke about the Genesis 1 because I figured, you know, the Christians here have been saturated with the young earth position in Genesis 1 and the evolutionary creationist position. They need to hear what we have to say from Reasons to Believe and how you don't have to abandon either the book of nature or the book of scripture. This Buddhist got up and said, well, basically, I'm hearing the same thing from these Buddhist groups I'm attending. And so, you know, what's the difference between Buddhism and Christianity when it comes to this stuff? So I basically responded by saying that particularly in coastal Asia, or coastal China, there are a lot of Buddhist sects that have syncretized with the Christian faith. And things that Buddhism never taught before is now part of the Buddhist faith. Excuse me. And because he made the comment, you know, I've heard one Buddhist group talking about grace, and you're saying this was unique to Christianity. He says, well, only in the last 20 years have you found Buddhist sects doing this. But it says if you will talk to these Buddhist leaders, they will tell you that they have indeed borrowed that all from the Christian faith. And the Buddhism never taught these things until they had exposure with the Christian faith. And he seemed to be okay with the answer, and then he got up again and made another long talk about why is Jesus the only way? And what about those who've never heard? And then he asked a question about why are good works inadequate? He was asking all the right questions. And at the very end, could aliens have deposited life on Earth? Which got a big laugh from everybody in the audience. And then his sixth question he asked was, you know, well, you know, does God play with dice? The whole question about Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein and the debate, does God play with dice or he doesn't? And so explaining why the Heisenberg uncertainty in quantum mechanics must be fine-tuned, that the uncertainty is too large or too small or too different from what it is, how quantum tunneling will not work the way it needs to work for proteins to function and won't be able to metabolize our food. And therefore, I concluded by saying God does play with dice, but he very carefully designs the dice ahead of time to get exactly the results that he wanted. Well, then he went on a long time again after that. And, you know, I was saying to my translator, I says, you know, the audience seems to have been getting annoyed with this guy. Maybe we need to just ask him to be brief. And he said, no, just let him go on, And so I said, okay, because, you know, he knew it was going. I didn't know what was happening. And then finally he said, well, he basically told the whole audience how grateful he was for all the answers you gave him and how he came that night trying to decide whether he was going to be a Buddhist or a Christian, and he had six major objections to the Christian faith and how all those objections had been answered by my answers, and that tomorrow he was going to get baptized as a Christian. So he told the whole audience that. Then he came up afterwards and, you know, shook my hand and said, you know, I've been going through this long battle about whether to be a Buddhist or a Christian, and it's just so comforting to have it settled once and for all. So that was a special way to end my trip to China, no doubt about it. But I also got to talk to a number of the house church leaders, and that was, you know, very gratifying, just the struggles they're facing. I don't know if you're aware of it, but the house church movement is underground. And the government is really doing what they can to suppress them. They want to push all the Christians into the Three Self Church, which is a government-sponsored church. But these sermons do get censored, whereas in the house churches, they have the freedom to say what they want, but they're under severe persecution from the government. And so just had a good time talking to them through a translator. And my last event, last two events, was on Friday. I actually came back to Hong Kong, and that was to do a breakfast of the HSBC Bank. That's the biggest bank in China. And so we were on the top floor of the HSBC building, a phenomenal building. It's a 44-story building where all the floors are optional. They can take a floor out or add a floor, so you can have a 30-foot ceiling or a 10-foot ceiling. And if they want to change things down the road, they just take the floors out. Yeah, it's specially engineered to make all that happen. It's the only building of its kind in the world. And since I was a scientist, they wanted to show me exactly how the engineering works. And, you know, it is quite an interesting design. But we were on the very top floor doing this breakfast. And basically, they had me give my testimony to all these bankers and business leaders. And we broke a record for a number of people attending. Broke a record for a number of pastors attending, and I got to talk to quite a few of the pastors afterwards, and they said, you know, we'd really like to form a coalition to bring Reasons to Believe out for a major creation conference. So I got to talk to them about that. I got some very interesting questions during the Q&A time, because I actually shortened my testimony a bit, because you got to be done in 20 minutes. So I got done in about 16 minutes, because we had no clock there. And I couldn't use my keynote, so I didn't have a clock there either. And so they said, you got 4 minutes left. Let's field some questions. Well, the Q&A got extended to about 20, 25 minutes, and nobody left. So, and this one lady got up and asked a question about nutrition. And so I talked about the interface between cosmology and nutrition. So I won't go into the details, but it got everybody really thinking about how you integrate across the scientific disciplines, not just the books of the Bible. And then afterwards, met with a physicist by the name of Alfred Tang, and we talked about how to establish a Hong Kong chapter of Reasons to Believe. We already have about 40 names of people who want to get involved, and already have, you know, a number of physicists who will form the backbone for that chapter. So we'll see what happens in the future. I'm 2 minutes over, but
that clock's wrong. You're right on time.
I'm actually right on time? All right. Well, so much for talking about life on Mars. Oh, one other thing. I have to give this to Jeff Swearing. This is actually yak jerky. Now, you can't get this in China. My host actually went on a vacation to Tibet and got this from Tibet. But because it's from Tibet, you're not allowed to have this stuff in China. So they're extremely sensitive to all this Tibet stuff. So I'm not allowed to taste it. I'm supposed to give this to Jeff Swearing. You want to know why? Because the principal of the school in Qingdao used to be part of a Bible study here in the L.A. area near UCLA, where Jeff Swearing was on the faculty there a number of years ago. So they're actually in the same study. Yeah, they have yaks in China, but I mean, it's Mongolia and Tibet that really has a lot of that stuff. And because yaks are associated with Tibet, what they were telling me was anything that can be associated with Tibet is taboo. Likewise, Taiwan.
We need to pray.
All right. Father in heaven, thank you for this time. Lord, I want to thank you for your grace and the strength that you gave me to get through all those events in China and Hong Kong. And Father, we do pray for those countries that your message continue to ring out through that land. And Father, too, we thank you for the efforts inside China to send a large missionary force here to the United States to bring Americans to faith in Christ. Lord, we're so grateful that you've raised up so many within China, for there's now more Christians in China than in America. And thank you for giving them a vision to reach America for Christ. And Lord, we pray that together, arm in arm, we can work together to fulfill the Great Commission. In Jesus' name, amen. That was one reason why this event at the university was impromptu.